Thought there was a song there. I didn't realize I was... I'm up already. A few weeks ago, I started a three-part sermon series by telling you about the sword and the stone and reluctant leadership. Today, I have another story to tell. Have you heard of Percival? Percival. He was a knight in the court of King Arthur. And returning from a quest, he found himself lost in a deserted wasteland, a barren land devoid of life. It looked like a forest fire had burned through, leaving nothing but bare soil and rocks in its wake. I gotta get rid of this cough drop, sorry. Allergy season is awful. All right. There were no trees and no squirrels, not even birds twittering above. What had happened to this fertile valley? Percival came upon a lake, and as his thirsty horse drank, he saw a small rowboat off in the distance. It was a worn boat with chipped purple paint. He waved, and the boat paddled toward him. It was paddled by two men, one in regular clothes and one in a shabby purple velvet suit and an off-kilter golden crown, a prince. As they drew up to him, Percival bowed and asked where he might find lodging for the night in this deserted land. The prince invited him to stay in the castle, and soon he was entering a bejeweled palace 7 stories high, with richly embroidered tapestries hanging on the walls in bright colors and painted portraits of past monarchs in golden frames. The carpet beneath his feet was so thick that it was like walking on a cloud. But every surface was covered with a thick layer of dust. Moths nibbled on the beautiful tapestries. Entering the banquet hall, Percival saw finely engraved silver platters and hand-stitched cloth napkins. But there was so little food. The chewy roast of an aged animal, dropping asparagus and wilted broccoli, mushy apples dressed with flavorless spices. However, there was fresh fish, courtesy of the fishing prince. But the people around the tables had no appetite. They just pushed their food around with their forks, and they ate nothing. Percival ate his fill of the delicious fish, and he talked to his table mates about the weather and the price of grain. Nothing serious. But he noted their markedly depressed faces, the purple circles under their eyes, their hunched posture. Even the youngest child had wheezing, difficult breath. It was as if the whole community was ill, yet they carried on with social niceties without commenting on their troubles. Percival was introduced to the king, who reclined on velvet, threadbare pillows, too weak to even sit upright and greet a guest. He found it hard to speak with the man because his suffering was so great. Open sores covered his face, and it was clear that it hurt him just to speak. Percival thanked the king for his hospitality and quickly turned away. The next day, he saddled his horse before anyone else was awake and rode home. Upon his return in King Arthur's court, there was a huge banquet to celebrate his successful quest. He was greeted as a victor and a hero and toasted again and again until an old sorceress said, "We are celebrating this fool's victory, when we should be berating him for his failure." On his return journey, he came across a kingdom cursed by an evil wizard. The spell, which was cast generations ago, made everyone, every inhabitant, sick, so sick they could hardly work, so ill they can't enjoy the pleasures of life, even the simplest things. Every person, every child, is so ill that the fields are fallow because no one can work. The castle is in disrepair. Sorrow fills the heart of every single soul. King Arthur interrupted, "And what could Percival do about that? He isn't a doctor, he isn't a wizard or a soothsayer. How can we blame him?" The sorceress replied, "To break the spell and cure every person in that kingdom, to bring them not just health, but happiness and hope, all an outsider needs to do is show compassion for one villager. One peasant, one king, or one child, it doesn't matter. Empathy, an acknowledgement of their pain, a soft and sympathetic word, the spell would break." But Parsifal turned away from their suffering. He chose to barricade his heart against their hardship, and so the curse continues. I have to admit, I feel a little sorry for Parsifal. Maybe I relate to his turning away. Maybe Parsifal had a really long day and just wanted to go home and rest. He was tired and he missed his own bed and he needed a shower. And then he comes on this odd situation, this ghost town full of half-living souls. Parsifal is a nice person, but sometimes, after a long day, all of us long to turn our heads toward home and just rest. A few weeks ago, when I talked about the sword and the stone, we talked about hope. And you might recall there are two kinds of hope. There's regular hope, which is passive. Passive hope is betting on something that's almost a sure thing, like finding a parking spot at the mall. There are thousands of parking spots at the mall. You'll find a space. Active hope is more active. Active hope is seeing a problem and choosing to move in the direction of fixing that problem. Active hope doesn't require optimism. As you know, maybe many of our greatest battles for justice were fought even though it seemed hopeless almost all of the way through. Often the leaders with the greatest vision do not live to see their vision come to light. And that's okay too. Active hope asks that we accept that real transformation might not happen in our lifetime. We do the work anyway for our children and our grandchildren, for future souls we may never meet. But what will sustain us on this journey? What will fuel our souls for this great quest ahead of us? Gratitude. We talked about gratitude and how it was being grateful for small things that strengthened us. The thankfulness built us up, so instead of burying our heads in our pillows, instead of blocking out all the earthquakes and pollution and poverty, we can see reality without breaking or even bending. But what about Parsifal? What does his story tell us? Parsifal exemplifies part two of our plan. We have to honor our pain as we move toward transformation. Parsifal wouldn't let himself feel the kingdom's sorrow. He didn't want to look at the king's suffering. Instead, he turned away, and their torment continued. Never before has a culture been so inundated with messages to be happy as we are in the United States today. The desire for happiness is the driving force behind marketing, behind the fluffiness of our news programming, even behind feel-good religious movements like the prosperity gospel. We are pushed to be happy all the time, and if we aren't happy, there must be something wrong, something that a product could fill or a medication could fill. We should be happy. But the thing is, there are lots of things wrong, lots of some things to be unhappy about. Plenty of folks in authority positions don't think that Black lives matter. Shell will soon be moving Alaskan oil through our fragile ecosystem, risking the lives of millions of unique sea creatures in the sound and threatening the viability of our economy. Our state system of taxation provides only the most miserly pittance to our schools and our infrastructure and our emergency services, allowing millionaires to dodge paying hardly anything. Can you look at all of this? Can you look in the king's eyes without looking away and say,
that must really hurt. I'm sorry. I am sorry that your school chemistry textbook is 15 years old. I'm sorry that your habitat is in grave danger. I'm sorry that authority figures are apparently allowed to kill you without being punished. That's horrible. My soul grieves at your suffering. Let me weep with you. Until we can sit with this pain, our kingdom will not be saved. The waters will not be safe. The children will not be adequately educated. And hopelessness and despair will continue to rush through Black lives like an ever-flowing stream. So as we take the hand of those who are pawns to injustice, we clasp those hands in our own and we say, I see you. I see it. You matter to me. Your despair is my despair. And we will weep together until that grief makes us strong, until that grief fortifies us, so that when we will rise united, hand in hand, a dam to stop even the mightiest stream, even the biggest ocean. And the pain will stop. And the injustice will recede. My dear spiritual companions, don't be afraid to not be happy. Let the pain of this world into your bones and let your tears fall. There is strength in sadness. There is power in grief. When I worked as a student hospital chaplain during seminary, I had the honor of spending time with the last generation of Holocaust survivors. There are so few people left that lived in concentration camps as children and survived that atrocity. Today, the men and women who were children in those camps are at their life's end, and they're trying to make sense of that living nightmare that engulfed their entire world, or trying to make sense of the guilt about being one of the very few people to survive. The hurricane of rage and sadness had consumed one woman, who we're going to call Ethel, who lay on her deathbed. Her body hummed with rage. Her anger was a palpable force in the room. I was called in to meet with her because her children were at their wits' end trying to speak with her, trying to say goodbye as she lay dying, but she couldn't even talk to them because she was so angry. When we were finally alone, I took her tiny white hand in mine and she just started yelling, "How could God let this happen? My whole family died. My sisters withered away with hunger and sickness and died miserably on the ground. My brother fought back and was shot point blank in the chest. And I heard about it because a guard was laughing at me because he was dead. My parents were burned the second we walked into camp when they realized that they were too old to work. I was alone. I was 8 years old and I was alone. I just kept my head down and worked and prayed for death to come quickly and painlessly. But I was the only one who made it. Could I have saved them? Was there something I could have done or said to help my sisters, to help my brother? Could I have changed all of this? Why did I survive? The thing is, Ethel didn't talk about any of this after the war, after the camps were liberated. She immigrated to the United States, and it just wasn't done. Who wanted to talk about all those horrible times? She married. She had children that were gloriously free, splendidly safe, incredibly, glowingly healthy, and she rejoiced that their life was so different than hers. Why burden them with this tale, these children of a new world? They knew anyway. They could see the numbers tattooed on her arm. So why talk about it? It was enough to suffer through the nightmares. And now the angel of death hovered in the room, and peace had not been made in Ethel's soul. Now she was too angry to die. She was caught in a limbo between denial and being too ill to keep living. Now it was time for a reckoning. The thing is, when suffering goes unacknowledged, it festers. It becomes infectious and it spreads. Ethel needed to tell her story. She needed to weep with her children. She needed them to truly know her, all of her. I helped her to write poems, furious laments to God, lacerating words that healed. She used the poems to start sharing her story, first with her family, and then with students at a local rabbinical school who crowded around her hospital bed, eager for her wisdom, admiring of her incredible resilience. And Ethel wept as she heard their stories, these future rabbis who were the children of Holocaust survivors, of parents who were so broken by the Holocaust that they could not show their children affection. They couldn't hug or say, "I love you." Parents who jumped at the slightest sound, at the sound of a firework outside. Parents who cried all night long. Of grandparents who admitted feeling jealous of their grandchildren's freedom in this new world, of their incredible safety, of their fearless pride at being Jews, wearing a yarmulke on the street without fear. These stories wove a tight blanket around Ethel. They embraced her, shouting, "You are not alone. You were never alone. It wasn't your fault that they died. Humanity should have cared for you better. Humanity failed, but you were never alone." Swaddled tightly in those stories, Ethel passed away one evening, her children within reach, a calm smile on her face. Her kids couldn't believe her forehead. They had never seen it. Seen the tension released in her forehead. They hardly recognized her now that she had set that burden down and was free. Sharing her story didn't fix it. The Holocaust still happened. She still mourned, but she knew she wasn't alone and that people saw her grief and they wept with her. There was relief in company. There was freedom in telling that story. We must embrace the pain of the world or fail like Parsifal to break the spell of suffering that has our world in its grip. We are strong enough through practicing gratitude, through standing together to face the reality of pain. We can use our stories to heal. We can handle our sorrow with rituals, whether ancient or freshly created. When my heart is heavy with grief for the people of Nepal or the souls of Baltimore, I like to build a cairn in the woods. You know, those little piles of stone that tell hikers which direction to go. I like to build a cairn over in Carkeek Park, a cairn of grief. And then I go down to the beach and I pitch rocks as hard as I can into the water. And I ask the water to take some of this pain away. And the water gratefully provides respite. I talk to my spiritual leaders. I breathe in peace and I breathe out love during meditation. And the grief becomes manageable. And not turning away makes me feel less alone because I'm united with all who suffer. This is our second practice of a three-part sermon series. The first was noting our gratitude in a journal or aloud with a partner or while we brush our teeth, just acknowledging all the things we have to be grateful for. And the second thing is feeling our pain, letting it soak in so that we're connected with the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are one tiny little part. The pain acknowledged will bring relief to the whole kingdom, the whole planet, and all will know that they do not suffer alone. Express gratitude. Feel the suffering. And next week, we will talk about seeing our world with new eyes and moving forward in strength. Now we will sit for 2 minutes of silent meditation.